All right, we're going to be talking about a four-letter word here. The picture that we have associated with this is a warning sign saying uncertain outcome ahead. I thought that pretty well fit for our sign theme here, and fear. So going to go right into it, and there we go. So I have a picture, a very close-up of like jean material that's been torn, and you can see the fabric inside the material there. And notice that the word fear, this is on the bottom of bottom of 69, is what page we're on. So 67. That's right, bottom of 67. Thank you. So bottom of 67. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. And what I do at this point is I have the guys turn back to page 65 and notice that the word fear is, you know, I like that idea of just doing what it says. Notice and again, go back and look at it. So this short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. Now, this is where I might differ with some people in terms of folks talking about a healthy fear. I'm not sure how you can have a healthy, evil, and corroding thread. There is, conceptually for me, there's two forms of fear. And the analogy I like to use is you walk up on the front porch, you knock on the door bursts open, and a pit bull knocks you down and has you by the throat on the porch. Now, for me, what's going to happen is one of the things that's going to happen is that my blood from my extremities is going to come in. And for the guys here, what happens is our gonads are going to go right up into our bodies. That's protecting the family jewels. That happens. The adrenaline level is going to kick in. One of the other things that happens is the immune system gets diminished. That's very interesting, isn't it? Because, and I was reading an article about this, and the gazelle, who's being chased by the lion, gets its leg injured, but gets away. It does the gazelle absolutely no good to get swelling in that leg at that time and sending a lot of white blood cells into that leg. Because the very first thing is get out of the way, and then later on you can have it swell up and heal and take care of it. So literally, fear produces a condition where I'm not as well as I could be. I actually produce a condition where I'm going to be less safe. You know, my body's immune system being diminished is pretty interesting thing there, right? Now, so all of these things happen in fear, with physical fear, when you're physically in that kind of environment. Psychological fear is when I'm afraid to get out of the car and go up on the front porch because I'm imagining the pit bull coming down and attacking me. It's not as strong as physical fear, but it produces the same kinds of effects in the body. The blood comes in from the extremities. The immune system starts getting shut down some. The adrenaline pumps, we've all seen that, right? So it's not, to me, it's not really the healthy, and this has to do with my definition of fear, you know, to call it fear. There is a thing Bill uses, a big word he uses all the time, called prudence, okay? And prudence is don't go into the house with the sign that says beware of dog, right? Prudence simply means, in the Latin, means to foresee. We call it run the tape forward. It's very prudent that I don't drink. It doesn't do me any good to be afraid of drinking. But I can look and say, I know that that if I drink again, I'm convinced that I become a different person. And I cannot predict what that person's going to do on the other side of the drink. It's not prudent for me to drink. I'm going to be going to Europe here. What happened was I met the flag bearer from Hungary at the 2015 International. And he's hooked me up with some other people. I'm going over there to visit my friends. I've never been in Europe before, and I'm going to have a host of friends when I get there. Okay? Somebody was asking me about, you know, the terrorists and all this stuff. I got a new employer being all-powerful. He provides what I need as long as I stay close to him and perform his work well. right? And that's that thing. That's why the third step is so critical to making that real decision. And when I go in, it makes the fourth step so much easier. But eventually, sometimes through the fourth step, I can begin to get this idea that, yes, I do. When I look back on my life and I've behaved this way, I've always been taken care of. Dana.
Yeah, I mean, you know, me and him are a little different in some things. And you know, Bill tried four things to stay sober. He tried geographic change, self-will, self-knowledge, and fear. And none of them worked for him. Me being scared of alcohol is not going to do anything for me. I've been scared of it before. It didn't do anything to me. But if I have a healthy solution behind my fear, then I have a better chance of not using again. So am I fearful of alcohol? Absolutely. But I'm not as scared of it anymore because I have a healthy solution that has worked for me for a long time. So,
so the next, this is a picture of Indiana Jones being chased by that big giant ball out of the cave, and he's just stolen something, right? He's stolen the idol, and he's trying to get out with the idol, right? So it really, I love the image here because of the paragraph is, you know, it set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune. I think he has a little misfortune there, don't he? And a train of circumstance that we felt we didn't deserve, you know? And these trains of circumstances are very interesting, don't you think? This idea that it's just, that this one little thing of fear can have this domino effect in my life, creating one thing after another, and actually the fear, instead of it's back with the resentments, thinking the shields are up, Scotty, when in fact the fears are the prison bars encaging me. And they're also setting off trains of circumstances. A fearful person, I don't know that I get the opportunities that I would get of one who trusts and relies on God. I get more opportunities in my life to be able to be useful and be helpful. So it says, sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. I thought that was a very strange analogy. Did anybody else think that was an odd kind of a metaphor to be using? And then I realized you can't steal from yourself. And I realized that fear had been stealing me from my kids. It had been stealing me from my wife. It had been stealing me from my job about being a good employee. It stole from all of those people. Yes, it should be classed with stealing, and it's because it is affecting other people. And when I saw that, I went, of course. You know, I think it's protecting me, and what it's really doing is it's stealing from others. And it seems to cause more trouble than stealing. You know, and I think there's many stories here that can understand that. Dana?
No, I like it. You have to sort of sit down and think about it, but you know, if you're racked with fear, you can't be full of faith. You know what I mean? And if you're not full of faith, you're blocked from the sunlight of the Spirit, and you're stealing time from your friends, from your family, from yourself, you know, and I just don't want to live like that anymore. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Next page, and this is a character just sitting down, his arms on his knees, his hand over his head, you know, despondent, you know. And Dana, why don't you go ahead and read that?
We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. There's your first column. Even though we had no resentment in connection with them, we asked ourselves why we had them. There's our second column. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but did not go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. And, you know, here we get into clear-cut directions out of the big book again on how you do your fear inventory. You know, there's your first two columns. We put them on paper. And why do we have them? This is my fear. Why do I have this fear? And, you know, and wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? My self-reliance always failed me. Whenever I relied on myself and relied on what I thought was the best idea, it failed me. And I got scared because I didn't know what the outcome was going to be. And then it says here, self-reliance was as good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us had great self-confidence. I feel like I had self-confidence, but deep down inside, I didn't feel like I was enough. I didn't feel like it was good enough, you know? And and then, but it didn't solve the fear problem fully or any other. It just made us, when it made us cocky, it made us worse. And I don't know about you, when I'm arrogant and when I'm cocky, things get a lot worse for me. So I don't know about you all. Go ahead.
Yeah, on page 87, it says, we pause when agitated or doubtful, and I add, or cocky, you know, because it's something I got to watch out for. I think the one here for me is Bill's asking, you know, he asks the question, why? But then it's great. He gives us the answer. Self-reliance failed us. And I found a good exercise for this is to have somebody write down, how has self-reliance failed you? And it works out pretty neat just to put down a list of how self-reliance had failed you, because you get a really good definition of self-reliance and what that means. And then it becomes a lot easier to fill out the rest of the form. So if anybody is in trouble with that section of it, I find that that's a good icebreaker right there. Now we're going to come over to this next one. This is one of the great understatements in the Big Book. You know, we've got all of this stuff, fear, we've got an evil corroding thread, the fabric of our existence is shot through with it, it's classed as stealing, it causes more trouble. Perhaps there's a better way. Does anybody else find that funny? Just perhaps, you know. Somebody comes in the room, they're miserable, they're suffering, their life, everything's falling apart, and you can look at them and go, perhaps there's a better way. You know, isn't that neat that we can do that? I like the other thing is when somebody's talking to me about something, I'll go, yeah, how's that working for you? Boy, it turns out to be a great question. And you don't have to say anything else. I almost always get, well, not very well. Perhaps there's a better way. So I can start off with the question, how's that working for you? And then say, perhaps there's a better way. You know? And that's what this is. So we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. What's the other basis? Trying to arrange life to suit myself so then I'll be happy. Trying to get my conditions right so then I'll be happy. That's the old basis. That's what we call the old freedom. And the new freedom that they talk about in the promises for me is doing what I ought to do because I want to do it. So, we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We've tapped into a power, this resentment. This is this idea on the Lord's Prayer that I like to use, forgive us our debts because as we forgive our debtors, just because I'm an old contracts guy. And I have all these contracts with my wife and other people. Now, they don't have a copy of the contract, a little omission on my part. But they should know what the clauses are, right? And they're violating these clauses all the time of this contract. And forgiveness is my ability to tear. I can tear the contract up. But let me give you an example. Let's say that I loan you $10,000, and you're supposed to pay me some amount every month. And 2 years later, you haven't paid me a dime. Now, if my relationship with you is most important thing, and I have $4 billion in the bank, it's going to be easy for me to tear up that little contract, isn't it? Because I want that relationship with you. You see, because my relationship with God is the sum total in so many ways, plus more, of my relationship with you. My relationship with God is this, my collective relationship I have with those around me, God's kids. God is everything or he's nothing. So my relationship with everything is my relationship to God. So I can tear up this contract, you see. And that's this idea, because I can rely on God to provide what I need. We're back to that page 63 on that Thursday. I have a new employer being all-powerful. He provides what I need. So I'm on that basis now, not on the basis of protecting myself by having make sure you give me back what I need. So then I can all of a sudden, I can be on a different basis. And so so just to the extent that we do, we are in the world to play the role he assigns. What I do there is I look at the way I was put together. I have an ability to put concepts together that some other people don't see. I'm also tall. Am I proud to be tall? Does that make any sense? What I realize today is I didn't create me. And if I didn't create me, then there's nothing to be proud of. There's many, many things to be grateful about. I didn't pick my parents. I didn't pick this country. I like that idea. Proud to be an American. I mean, what did I do? You know, I was out, you know. I'm very grateful to be an American. But to be proud is an incorrect. It's just inaccurate. It's not the truth. So just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us, it doesn't even have to be the way, I try to do what I think, just to the extent that I do that, okay, and humbly rely on him, back to that new employer, does he enable us, the power flows through, he enable us to match calamity with serenity. And I think of the power not as this little bucket that I'm carrying around, but I think of it as a pipe connected to the Pacific Ocean. It's a power that flows through. It does not emanate from me and my little bucket. Dana.
Yeah, you know, what sticks out to me a lot in that and what I think about a lot is humbly rely on him, and he enables us to match calamity with serenity. You know, what a freaking promise that is. You know, to be able to, calamity's going to happen. Life is going to happen to us. It's going to happen. Things happen. You know, and you know, unfortunately, I don't live in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, where everybody is nice and everybody's, you know, seems like this credo that everybody treats everybody with respect. It just doesn't happen all the time. And there's calamity in my life. People get sick, people die, I lose my job, I rack with fear. But if I can match that calamity with serenity, that is pretty cool, you know, to me. That's what I'm looking for, is when calamity comes up in my life, can I match it with serenity? Do I have my higher power in my corner? Like, I like your analogy of the pipe in the Pacific Ocean. Is it big, that big, you know, can it do it? And it can. So that's it.
Now, we're coming up to this next paragraph. Now, there's a book out there that was originally called The AA Way of Life as Bill Sees It. It now has the title As Bill Sees It, The AA Way of Life, because they realized Bill was trying to change some wording in the first 164 pages. And this is an example. And what I've got on the screen is how it is in the fourth edition, and really all the editions. And then page 129 of As Bill Sees It and the different wording that he took. Now, when I first read this, I thought that it was a mistake when I first read it. And I found it interesting to see that Bill thought it was the same way. And let's read it. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. And I heard that and I said, laughing at someone does not sound like a very spiritual thing to do. Let's look at the paragraph the way Bill rewrote it. We need not apologize to anyone for depending upon the Creator. We have good reason to disbelieve those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Now, it's not because he had too little room on the page to print it. If you go pull it up, there's lots of room that he could have put that in there. So there's a change that he was looking at making there. And it says in the original version, it says, the verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. I really like that part too. At once we commence to outgrow fear. What Bill says following, and as Bill sees it, he suggests instead of saying we have good reason to disbelieve those who think spirituality is a way of weakness, for us it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that men of faith seldom lack courage. Okay, he's qualifying a little bit. They trust their God, so we never apologize for our belief in him. Okay, another slight. Instead, we try to let him demonstrate through us what he can do. And that's that idea of, again, the power flowing through. So it's one of those interesting things that I find in the big book, Dana.
On the end there, it says, we ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what we would have us to be. At once we commence to outgrow fear. That's your fear prayer right there. And that's found on page 68 in the middle of the page there, and at the bottom of the page. And, you know, the one thing that I always have, going back to the first slide that we talked about, was patience. And I want things, I don't know about y'all, but I want it, and I want it now. And it just, when I don't get it now, I get frustrated. And right now it says we start to outgrow fear. It says that once I start to outgrow it. Doesn't mean it's gone away immediately, but at least I can identify it and start outgrowing it. You know what I mean? That's a big thing for me. And it took a long time for me to be, you know, you go back to Mr. Brown and you look at how many times fear is listed and all this kind of stuff. And I wish that there was a magic switch, like on a switch box at your house, like a circuit breaker, that I could go, fear, gone, and it'd be gone. But it doesn't happen that way. I have to outgrow fear, and I outgrow fear by exercising my faith muscle. You know, the more faith I have and the more results I get from that faith, the more I start to outgrow fear. Because I don't know about you all, but I write the movie, I hire the actors, it's all written in my head, and it's always an absolute horrible ending, right? It's never, oh, this is a good movie, and at the end it's everybody plays nice in the sandbox. It's never that way in my mind. But what happens is I walk through that fear, and I see on the other side that God, Danny and I were talking about it before the meeting today, how he walked through something, as we all do, and we walk through it with faith, and we know it's the right thing to do. And when we get to the other side, that fear is not so big next time, you know? So we're outgrowing that fear, okay?
Okay, next slide. This is where we're going to be talking about sex. We're going to have 15 minutes to do sex, which is the average in the United States. We have on the slide is a picture of all the different possible combinations, you know, man, woman, women, women, men, women. And what's neat about AA is we don't want to be the arbiters of anybody's sex conduct. I am so glad of that as a sponsor, you know, that I don't need to be the judge. And it's beautiful the way Bill put this together. So on this screen, I have a picture of a hot pepper, and I've got a little angel, you know. So this is that idea. This is starting on the bottom of 68. So now about sex. And we're really, again, this is talking about our thinking about sex. You know, it's also not talking about, you know, the actual, but the thinking and how we use this. And I like that analogy from Joe and Charlie, that they really say this is what we're talking about. So many of us needed an overhauling there, but above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. Bill uses the sensible another time in the ninth step. He says we should be sensible, tactful, and considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. And I like this. You know, this really is a sensible program, isn't it? It really is. One of the beautiful things about it. So, I wasn't always sensible, especially when I was drinking. Does anybody remember being sensible when we were? No, it wasn't one of those qualities. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cries that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. And the idea, you know, this other group says, then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow a man no flavor for his fare, thus the hot pepper, and the other would have us, no flavor for our fare, the kind of angel, you know, it's, and the other world, would have us on a straight pepper diet. This is the beautiful, we want to stay out of this controversy. You know, as a sponsor, I need to make sure I stay out of the controversy. That's not what we're here to do. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we don't. What can we do about them? And the answer is going to be about, for a sponsor, is to help that person shape their own ideal, not to impose my ideal on them and what I think they should be doing and not doing, because then I'm playing God again, right? So all we're doing is, and that's what I can do, is I can show how I shaped a sound and sane ideal. For me, the sex problem was a big thing. I mean, I had a pull your pants down club with a girl down the street at 6 years old. We were the only two members. I mean, it started early for me. You know, I was one who, things were going along fairly well. I was getting a little bit restless, irritable, and discontent. And then I went to a strip joint with a guy who was, it was a bachelor party, and I was back at the pull your pants down club again. You know, and I thought, boy, this is the adult style. They're doing it with flair, you know, here. And then I went to a massage parlor just to get a massage, and the gal offered the full treatment. And I took her up on it, you know, because I really wasn't getting as much as I wanted, you know, at home, you know. And I told myself in China and Japan, they have concubines, you know. You know, a woman on this, of course, the wife knows about it. It's part of the culture. Well, here's the delusion. See, this is not about denial. This is about delusion. I'm not in China or Japan. My wife's not Chinese or Japanese. And I'm sure as hell not going to tell her what my thinking is, you know. But I'll tell you what happened. Mama raised me better than that. And I had that sense of guilt. And that started, really, my drinking alcoholically started after that point, because I was acting out. And I was wanting to be one way, and I was acting a completely different way. And I was getting pleasure by sneaking around, the way I used to sneak out of the house when I was 12 and 13 years old. I think a great question for an alcoholic is, what would a grown-up do? Isn't that a great question? What? Let's pretend I'm a grown-up. What would a grown-up do? Dana.
You know, this sums it up. I mean, it's in there. I mean, you know, you all know I teach the big book. I love to teach the big book. And when we get to this part of the inventory, sometimes I'm teaching women exclusively, and I don't go into this. I think it sums up exactly what it does. And we'll go through in the next few slides. There again, clear-cut directions. You know, there's very clear-cut directions on how to do this inventory and how to act as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think if we follow those directions, we can stay in check. Whatever your deal is, it doesn't matter. You know, what matters is that you have to have an ideal, and you have to live up to that ideal, and you have to be honest about it. And that sums it up right there for me. Go ahead.
Great. Next slide. And this is where I lay this out. We reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Again, I like the fact that Bill starts off with the where first. I've seen a lot of people who start off with the who first. But Bill's not really saying that. He's starting with the where first, which is under what conditions, again. Because I'll tell you what, given the same conditions, I did the same harm over and over again to different people. And so then I'm just bragging if I do it the other way. I can put the one set of conditions, and a lot of times it was when I was not getting what I wanted when I wanted it. And, you know, on the sex thing, sometimes it's not enough, and then, whoa, that's way too much, and not enough, and then, whoa, that's way too much, you know. And that's that idea of perfection again. And I like what the way Bill's answer to this is just brilliant. So where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? That'd be column two. Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? And the unjustifiably part for me is I can't control whether somebody is, you know, bitter or they're suspicious or jealous. But if I do something intentionally to make somebody that way so that I can manipulate and control them and get them to act a certain way, so then I've, again, gotten my conditions a certain way, so then I'll be happy, I'm back to playing the old game. Okay? And that's the importance for that column for me. Where were we at fault? That's column four. What should we have done instead? And this is the beauty of it. I've used it back on the original resentment inventory, and that's why I like this column. If it's good enough here, I really like it back there as well, because it's the same thing. What principle should I have been doing at that time? Because ultimately, this ties to step 12, right? Which is, we practice these principles in all our affairs. So I should be trying to list the principle I should have been doing, and then I'm actually performing part of step 12 at that time too. So, Dana.
No, there again, it's all laid out for you, and the thing that is amazing, it's not even five sentences, it's four or five sentences of how we lay out our sex inventory, you know, and it's all right there. And I think there again, I like the part where, you know, it starts out as the where had I been, not who, it's where. So go ahead.
Mm-hmm. So next slide, and this is where, in this way, this is this great, like, we tried to shape a sane. And now we can go back to sanity is proportion, right? So when I'm insane, I'm lack of proportion. Sanity is proportion. And here you have a picture of somebody who has got clay on a turntable, and they're spinning it up, and it's in beautiful proportion. And what they're going to try and do is mold it until it gets into just the right proportion of what their ideal is for this vase or this pot or whatever this person has in mind that they're doing. And I love that image of the shaping of it. That's what we're going to be doing, using this to mold and to shape this ideal. And it takes action to do that. And it takes power to do that. You got to pump on that thing and get that thing spinning. But eventually you're going to have to fire it and all of that good stuff. So I love the image. So the sound, we're trying to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. Okay? How am I going to behave in the future? We subjected each relation to this test. That's the current relations that I have, and I can also go back and look at past relations. So I can see, because really what I should, when I look at my ideal versus my actual behavior, I can see that difference between the two. And then I can begin to see what I should do instead. It helps me answer that last column. So we ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. This is not asking God for just the right behavior out of my sexual partner. Okay? I like this idea, the guy that said, I'm old, but I still enjoy sex, especially the one during summer. But anyway, it's a different kind. And what I do for me, this is to shape a united ideal between my wife and myself. Okay, something that's not just my ideal. For me, and this is just me, the way I do look at it is, what's one that we can both be doing the pot together. We can both be molding the clay together. And it's been a beautiful thing. We remember always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. And the idea here is, basically it looks as though if I'm doing sex for something other than fun and procreation, then I'm probably using it wrong. Dana?
Yeah, I mean, it's real simple. It's laid out for you. It says we subjected each relation to the test. Is it selfish or is it not? I think a lot of us in our previous lives, because of the ego and the pride and the power and the selfishness of it, we were not subjecting our relationships to the proper sex relationship. So now as we recreate our lives, as we do things different, is it selfish or is it not? I don't care what you do. I don't care what y'all's deal is. Doesn't matter. Is it selfish or not? Everybody's got a different deal of what they want to do. And then there's the sex prayer in there, and it says we ask God to mold our ideas and help us live up to them. God, these are my ideals. Let me go into this thing and let me not be selfish about it. And let's mold them and let me live up to them. And I loved what Damon said is, practicing these principles in all our affairs. If that's a principle, if that's something that you want to do and that's something, then you have to practice that principle. So
the next slide. And this one, I've got a picture of Luke Skywalker with Yoda on the back. And this is because we're talking about sharing this and talking over with a mentor. And I think he's one of the great symbols of a mentor to me. And with Yoda, but it's actually a time when he's training him during this part of the scene, and actually right after this scene is when he's talking about it, feeling the negative part of the Force, and he goes into the cave and he says, "What's in the cave?" He says, "Only what you take with you," and that's where he encounters the image of his father, Darth Vader, and the whole thing. So this idea is here. It says, "Whatever our ideal turns out to be," isn't that great? We don't want to be the arbiters again. And this is great when I'm sponsoring. I need to remember this. Whatever that person's ideal is to be, okay? Whatever it turns out to be, we must be willing to grow towards it. This is willingness again. I had a tremendous willingness to do this program. I cannot take credit for it. I've been working with a lot of guys in the jail, and they've had lots of opportunities. They've had plenty of resources and everything. And they didn't get it. I don't know. I don't know what makes me different to have this willingness to do this program, but I'm very grateful for it. But again, this is so much about willingness to do this. In some ways, we just may have to just start by praying for the willingness. And maybe you have to pray for the willingness to pray for the willingness. But Bill calls it the keystone through which we pass through this, this willingness. It is the key that unlocks the whole thing. So we must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in doing so. All right? Again, the same way we talk in the amends process, we're looking ahead to step 9. Maybe because Bill says some people want to go fix this real fast. Suggestion that it's a good idea to get through 5, 6, and 7 and 8 before you go out on your own and do 9. We've seen that mistake being made. It's probably not a good idea. Okay? Because this part of the steps are really very much in order for a reason. There's a way of getting prepared to do this properly, to truly do it with love and tolerance, and to be of service to the other person, not just to take the load off my shoulders. This is about trying to take it off of them, not take it off of me. And yet I get it. I get that as if they're not willing to take it off theirs, I've given them the opportunity. Let's see what we can do. So in other words, and this is fantastic, by the way. This is another one of those fantastic little hidden deals in here. We treat sex as we would any other problem. Wait a minute, let's turn that around. We treat any other problem the way we do sex. If it's not resentment and fear, you got any other problem, treat it the same way you do sex. You got the form. Where were we to blame? Whom had we hurt? Where had we been selfish, dishonest? It's the same form. Sneaky little guy, isn't he? But I love that, you know? And it's great news. So we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, okay, let's be clear. In 1937, meditation did not mean what it meant once transcendental meditation came through during the 60s. It's another one I've looked up. Meditation at that time is like the way a general meditates on a war, okay? So it's an idea of planning ahead, thinking about the resource, what resources you're going to use. Bill talks about it on 86 when he says, and when thinking about our day, we look ahead at our day. That's the kind of meditation he's talking about. But Bill was open to the other forms of meditation later on when they started coming in the 60s. He thought, and he was a great walker. He would walk in outside of stepping stones and do that. So we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answers will come if we want it. Now, God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. So this is the idea, to talk out with somebody else to make sure that I've got myself on the right straight, on the right path. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. So I'm going to skip on to the next one. I think you're okay with that, Dana?
Yep.
Okay. So now I need to examine my motives is what this is about. Okay. One of my grand sponsors, he would always ask, what's your motivation? I really need to look at that and behind each one of the things I'm doing. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. That's almost inevitable. Okay, I suppose is sort of funny there because I think it's inevitable. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but this is only a half-truth. It depends on us and on our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. Dana.
Yeah, I know we're over time, but, this is one thing that I really, really feel strongly about is, I see people not going to meetings and I see people with resentments and I see them drinking again. And the other thing that I see them doing when they drink again is when they run around on their partners and do things that they're not supposed to be doing because it goes against everything that we're trying to practice in here.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So, and here's a hand holding a big red heart. And then to sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal. Do you think ideal is a big deal in this thing?
Yep.
This whole thing is about developing and molding this ideal. So for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, that is, again, proportion in my life, okay, and for the strength to do the right thing, the power that I've tapped into, and that's knowing what I ought to do and being able, and wanting to do the right thing. So getting those in alignment. If sex is very troublesome, this is a great solution. We throw ourselves the harder into helping others. we think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves, and it quiets the imperious urge, imperial, empire, emperor, that kind, you know, that overpowering urge.
Urgent.
And yeah, and sex is that way. It's the king of all urges, right? And for a reason. That's why we're all here and we keep reproducing, because it's very powerful. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge, when to yield would mean heartache. Dana.
Yeah, 52 times in the first 164 pages it talks about working with others. And I can't think of a better way, especially when you're new in recovery and you know, you shouldn't be in focusing on a relationship on yourself. Go work with somebody else. I mean, you know, you give into it and you're going to feel guilt, shame, and remorse, and you don't need that.
Mm-hmm. So here we come up on, this is a quote from Henry David Thoreau: could a greater miracle take place than for us to look through each other's eyes for an instant? Isn't that great? That we could do that. And it says here, this is the sum up about all of this stuff we've been doing on the inventory. This is the sum it up section. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, okay, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and fatality. When I talk about guys in the jail ask about futility, I said, okay, just run headlong into that brick wall until you get out of jail. That's called futility. Okay, the brick wall is not going to care. All right? And the fatality, we've seen how many times that's mentioned in here. All right? We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies. And that's so true, too. And that's a powerful one right there. For we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct, and we are willing to straighten out the past if we can. And that power to do that is not mine. The power for me and the decision I need to be is to be willing. And then the power will come. The amazing things happen to me. I'm a retired atheist. I came in here as an atheist. I was convinced I could convince you there was no God. And today I rely on this power that tends to straighten these stuff out when I become willing and my motives are right. Dana.
Real quick, I mean, that's a psychic change. That's a change of thinking. That's what we're talking about doing. Go ahead.
So this is in this book, this is the last paragraph in that section, and this is a picture of a plant struggling to break through a very dried, you know, parched kind of earth, okay? And that's a great symbol for me about our lives, you know, and it seems so dead, and it seems so barren, it seemed like nothing was there, and yet this to me is a symbol of hope. And this is one of the greatest things we can give the newcomer or anyone who suffers. I mean, that's not just the newcomer, by the way. Our primary purpose is carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, and sometimes those people have 30 years in the program, and they're about ready to blow their brains out. So it's not limited just to that. In this book, you've read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. New employer, right? We hope you are convinced. Now, Bill used that right after the ABCs. He used it twice about being convinced. Being convinced and staying convinced, okay? That we hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. That's that unconscious stuff. That, right? If you have already made a decision, we know what that decision is, right? And an inventory of your grosser handicaps you have made. You haven't graduated. Sorry, you know, you've made a good beginning. Okay. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Dana.
No, I'm good with that. Like I said, we're way over. So, yeah. I mean, it's in the book, and, you know, I think it's good.
Okay. And here's what I kind of sum this up is, what can we expect from this strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us? The beginnings of a spiritual awakening. That's the deal here. The big prize is the spiritual awakening. And the other is unity. That's in the 12 traditions. That's the very first thing. This is, you know, an alcoholic in our cups is one of the loneliest creatures on earth. This is about getting connected and getting along. And I love this. This quote is from page 77 of the 12 and 12 in step 8. And to me, I just love it. It says, this is a psychic change. Learning how to live in the greatest peace, partnership, and brotherhood with all men and women of whatever description is a moving and fascinating adventure. okay? Not getting what I want, not getting a rifle range, the actual act of learning how to do it. Not to do it, but the learning how to do it itself is the moving and fascinating adventure. Dana?
No, I'm good.
And with that, peace. That's all we have.